survive if I let you.
Conquering nevermore.
Let the new era begin. The era of the ECW.
Oh my god.
Greetings, ECW fans, and welcome to This Is Extreme, the ECW History Podcast. I am your host, Dave Dynasty. Thank you for joining us for another episode. We have another great interview lined up for you today. We have ECW referee Jim Molyneux on, one of, I think, only two guys who was with ECW from the very beginning to the very end. Of course, it was Jim and his referee cohort, John Finnegan, who we had on an earlier episode. They were both with the company from the beginning of the Eastern days all the way through to the closing of the company. So a great interview with Jim coming up in just a bit. Not a whole lot of news to cover before we get there. Everything seems to be quiet on the extreme front for the most part. Make sure you are following me on social media. The commercial will be coming up. Do that. You can follow me personally on X at the Dave Dynasty. That is probably your central means to follow me and all the podcasts that I do is to follow that account. All right. So once again, thank you for joining us. Make sure you subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform, but let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll have that interview with Jim Molyneux. So stick around.
Be sure to follow This Is Extreme on all social media platforms. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for ECW Pod. Be sure to follow us, keep up to date, and join in the discussions. We want to hear your feedback, so find us on all the social media platforms and join the revolution.
This is extreme. All right, we're back on This Is Extreme, and I'm being joined now by an ECW referee who was there through the entire run of the promotion, Jim Molyneux. Jim, how are you?
Very good. How are you?
I am good. Let's start. The first question I always like to ask people is, how did you become a fan of professional wrestling?
Probably the same answer you get from everybody else. When, you know, Saturday afternoon watching it with my dad. My dad was a weekend warrior with motorcycle racing. Mm-hmm. So, but he wouldn't race as much as help run them. He was in a racing club, not a motorcycle club, a racing club. He made sure we knew the difference. and they would do enduro races through the woods against other teams. Just, you know, follow the arrow and make your own path. And all the guys on the team, most of them had apartments except for us. We had the house with a garage. So all the motorcycles were in our garage. So there was more tinkering than anything in our house with the bikes. And so he would tinker on Saturday morning. And when it was time for wrestling, clean up, come on in, watch wrestling, go back out to the bikes. But yeah, that was how I started. That's, you know, in the round way, that's, I guess, the way most people start.
Yeah, you grew up in the Northeast, right? So was it, I mean, were you New York? Is that what you were watching?
New York, yeah. I was watching the Philadelphia feed.
Yeah. So when did you decide, hey, this is something I want to get into, that I'd like to become involved with it?
It wasn't until I was 27 or 28. I was 28 when I did my first match. So I started kind of late. And what it was I got away from it for a while. Growing up in the Philadelphia area, became a huge hockey fan. So I was playing hockey a lot. In fact, at that age, I was still playing hockey in a ball hockey league, outdoor ball hockey league. So I was really tied up with that. I guess, you know, by the teen years, I got away from it because I wanted to play guitar and play in a band. And you know, I think a lot of people do have that mm-hmm. kind of dream too. So came to the point where I realized that no matter what I did, I wanted to entertain. I did some acting in high school and things like that. So I wanted to entertain people somehow. And I went to the Great American Bash, 1987. I think that's what it was, 87. And the main event wasn't this, but this is the match I remember the most, a double bull rope match with Dusty Rhodes and Ron Garvin against Ric Flair and Tully Blanchard. Yep. And I was in the third row and I'm like, man, this is great. I got to figure out a way to get involved. And I listened to the ring announcer and it was Joel Goodhart. Mm. And he had started the fan club. They had the fan club and the radio show going, but he hadn't started TWA yet. So I went and found a place to train. I wanted to be a manager because I knew there's no way I can be a wrestler. Fat little guy at 5'9" who can jump about 6 inches off the ground. So there's no way I'm going to be a wrestler. And I was a bit of a wise guy growing up. So I thought, maybe I can get away with, a smart mouth. So I started training to be a manager and did a couple of shows, created a character, the extravagant Jimmy Fortune. And I was going to have what my group of guys that were going to be called the Agents of Fortune, which was a Blue Oyster Cult album, a huge Blue Oyster Cult fan. So, so then I went to Goodhart, who by now had started TWA and had about a year under the belt with him. And I said, hey, I'm interested in coming in. Can do you think you can use me? And we were friends. It wasn't, just out of nowhere. And he was like, well, I don't need another manager, but I could use another referee. And he gave me the sale of the used carsman sale of being a referee. And he said, think about it for a couple of days and give me a call back. So I thought about it and I called him back 10 minutes later and said, yeah, I'm in. And I was down there. That was like a Thursday night or a Friday night. And next thing I know, Tuesday I was training. I was in a ring for the first time. And I trained for about 8 weeks before I went and actually had ref my first match.
Yeah, and TWA, obviously kind of the predecessor to ECW.
Yeah.
So what was it like working there, right? Because there was a lot of similarities, a lot of things carried over. But Joel, man, he did some huge shows. I mean, brought in some huge talent. Probably too big, right? That's kind of his downfall was,
Yeah, it was.
If things didn't, if he wasn't drawing when he needed to draw, he was losing the money. So what was it like working for TWA? Because they had a lot of attention at that time.
Right. Yeah, we were getting a lot of attention. What we do is, he would do those big shows that you're talking about three times a year at the Philadelphia Civic Center, one of the exhibition halls, not at the big arena where the NWA ran. So he would do those about three times a year. The rest of the year, we would do local shows, high schools, rec centers, the typical indie setup, and would bring one or two guys in, former WWE, former NWA, a recognizable name. But we were also building a good group amongst ourselves. We had guys who were known on the independent circuit, DC Drake, Larry Winters, Tony Stetson, Johnny Hotbody, guys who are well-known local. Plus, we were building out of our school, out of Joel's school. So we had a good mix of guys that could put on a show, just add a name for attraction, and then be able to be a part of the big shows that we did at the Civic Center with a lot of big names added.
Yeah, and like we said, essentially, TWA led to ECW, right? A lot of those same guys went over.
Right.
I believe was Todd, was he a sponsor in TWA? Was he sponsoring some stuff? Right. He had some involvement in there. Where were you when Tri-State folded? Right. Because obviously I believe it kind of hinged on that, the Nature Boy versus Nature Boy show, right? Where they had this huge show, didn't draw like they wanted. I mean, Joel. It was kind of an all of a sudden thing, right?
He realized that they were going to lose a shit ton of money. Are we cursing on this?
Yeah. Say whatever you want. Yeah.
He knew he was going to lose a lot of money. So that's why he pulled the show. And it was a shame because it was everyone thinks of that main event, Buddy Landell against Buddy Rogers, but also he was going to have Williams and Gordy against Furness and LaFont. Which a lot of people forget about. And that would have been the only time that it happened in the U.S. Otherwise, that was an big All-Japan match. And I would have sold a child to do that match.
And like I said, out of those ashes, right, like Larry Winters and some of those guys went and talked to Todd about hey, we've got something, right? Mm-hmm. There's enough here. Were you at all around those talks when it was happening?
No, I wasn't. I was told, keep stand by. We're trying to put something together. And really the people that were putting it together or involved in talking to figure a way to make it happen were Todd, Larry Winters, Bob Ortiz, who was our ring announcer, and John Finnegan was involved too, who refereed with me the entire time of ECW.
Yeah.
And he, John actually trained me. So John was kind of in on helping set things up.
Yeah. And Todd did, right. He went, and like I said, there was a lot of that same talent that flowed over. But Todd did have, he had a little more business, you know, mindset, right? He knew, had a little sensibility to know, hey, when the limit is, right? And so, you know, he did build off the back of TWA, started Eastern Championship Wrestling, right? Which you were there.
Right.
And it flowed over. So what was it like in those early days? Because Larry, I think Larry booked just a show or two, but then they pretty quickly brought in Eddie Gilbert, correct, to book?
Well, until we got the TV deal, it was Larry who was the booker.
Right.
Eddie came when they decided they were able to get local TV bigger than we actually had a local TV before what everybody knows is Eastern, where I think it was like a 5-block radius from this television station.
Yeah.
And everything that we did at the old Philadelphia Sports Bar was recorded, and that became that show. And then when it was time, we actually did a pilot to go to the local, at the time, Philadelphia Sports Channel, it was called.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We did a pilot, and Larry was the booker for that. And they had brought in, I know they brought in Ivan Koloff and Terry Taylor. They may have brought in another name or two, plus all of us local guys. That's what sold the show to the television station. And after that, somewhere in there, Todd decided he wanted to go with someone who had more experience with television, which I think was a shame because Larry did have a lot of experience with television. And I think we would have stayed on a path that we were already on, where Eddie kind of led us in another path. Not that it was a wrong path, but it led us in a different way. And we had to kind of reset a little bit. And Eddie brought in a lot of his people that he could trust, just like any booker.
Yeah.
Paulie did the same thing.
Yeah, and obviously Eddie brought in a lot of Memphis influence, right? Because Eddie came through Memphis, was a Memphis fan. Jerry Lawler, he was addicted to Jerry Lawler, right? Wanted to be Jerry Lawler. And so what was it like there when Eddie was booking? Could you see that? Did anybody ever feel, hey, is this guy just trying to make us Memphis light? Or what was the mindset while Eddie was booking there?
You know, it wasn't that different from Larry's mindset. Larry was a Northeastern version of Memphis TV. If you ever look it up, the old NWF that Larry was involved in with Drake, that was kind of, you know, look at those matches, and they used a lot of the same guys, or they even did like the same stipulations of matches, just plugged in their, you know, guys, their Jerry Lawler and their Eddie Gilbert and their Austin Idol. So a lot of it was still based on the Memphis theory. So it wasn't that far off. Eddie would come in, have 3 weeks worth of TV written down, put it up on the wall, and that was it. That was what we were doing.
And then obviously, right, Eddie left, right? I believe he went to Puerto Rico or whatever. And then Paul Heyman started booking.
Yes.
And what was the difference there, right? Because like you said, you said Eddie would have 3 weeks. There was at least some mindset, but everybody always talks about Paul was much more by the seat of his pants. Who was here? Okay.
Freelance.
There you go. Right. A little free flow in the thoughts. Was it jarring when, because obviously Paul was also bringing in some New York guys, right? So, and using, you know, obviously like anybody, like you said, like any booker will, but there was some new talent being in. Like, was it jarring at all in the locker room when this change happened?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think it was more jarring with the Memphis people who came in than it was the New York people, because a lot of the New York people we knew from independents and already, you know, had some familiarity with Taz, Tommy Dreamer, guys like that. Some of us had worked independent shows and knew them. Yeah. So it wasn't that jarring. The most jarring, like you said, Paulie being freelance or free form with his booking, would have a basic idea of the main event and maybe the couple semis. But otherwise, he'd look around the room, see, he'd come in, put his stuff down, get out his notebook, look who's around. put him with here, here, here. There are times where, you know, it's 8:15 and Paul, we need a match to start the show. So we'd get a match and you know, a referee would go out and we're sitting there still waiting for the other matches. You know, but Paul was different because he would edit differently than Eddie. Yeah. You know, Eddie would pretty much whatever was written down with Eddie, you know, match one, well, that was the first match that week. Match two, that was it. You know, Paul would just throw the matches out there, make sense with the crowd, and then play with them for TV.
Yeah. And Paul, I mean, Paul was a genius with the editing stuff, right? He knew how to edit to make guys look even shine even more than they did, right? He knew how to edit those, you know, the mistakes, the different things out to really get guys, I mean, guys over. And I mean, I guess Paul understood his methods. But then, like I said, you know, with his method, things, you know, evolved from Eastern, right? And then it got into Extreme, right? It came there, the Shane Douglas, everybody's talked about that, the throwing the title, they rebranded as Extreme. When that happened, right, and they went to the Extreme, as a referee, how did that affect you? Because the role of the referee was not traditional anymore, right? The rules were obviously a little looser. There weren't as many, you know, DQs being called. How did you have to adapt, or how did that affect you as a referee?
Well, I think when we were in the before we became Extreme, while Paul was there, the rules had become a little looser,
right? Yeah.
So we weren't doing a lot of count outs and giving guys a chance to get back in the ring and you know, seeing chairs or hearing chair, you know, however you want to look at it, letting things get a little wilder. We were already in that process of doing that. And I think just the name change from Eastern to Extreme was just to make us more acceptable in other parts of the country, because we were starting to get syndicated. We were going to start going to other parts of the country.
Yeah, a little less regional, right? Shows. Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, who wants to see Eastern Championship Wrestling in Florida?
Yeah, yeah. Did it ever bother you though, as a referee? That I mean, really, your roles kind of was. Were you ever? I don't know. It's odd to me to think I've never refereed, right? But it's odd to me to think, what is your place in a match? I mean, just to count the three. How hard was it you to make that to adapt to that?
Yeah, I never looked at it as all I'm there to do is count. I'm there to, especially with ECW, some of the crazy crowds that we had, you know, your eyes are on the match, but you're also watching and listening to the crowd.
Yeah.
There might be a fight breaking out. So, hey, guys, if you want to take it to a hold and let the fight happen, and once it's done, going back to the match, or do something to draw the people away from the fight.
Yeah.
Or even going through the crowd, you know, keeping, we had to go, we went through the crowd, I don't know how many times we were keeping people away.
Yeah.
You know, and thank God for security, not just Atlas security, but the guys we had before that, because they were keeping the fans away from the refs too. They were going to try to kill us.
Yeah. And there's obviously even prior, I mean, coming out of East, there was obviously something special, right? It had a feel. You could tell things were clicking, right? Things were happening. Could you feel that? Obviously, guys talk about that in the locker room, right? That they felt, hey, there's something happening here.
Right.
When did you, do you have a timetable at all when you noticed that, man, this is unique?
I think when we became Extreme and started going to other places, that was like, wow, we're getting into the big league, you know, area where, you know, I'm not going to be home tonight. You know, where if you're local and you're regional, you're pretty much home every night.
Yeah.
But this was different. This was like, wow, we're on the road. And not that we were on the road as much as WWE or WCW. We were still home for most of the week, but wow, we're going away. We're going somewhere. We're showing people what we're doing, and they seem to like it. I think once we, you know, when we got a positive crowd reaction from other parts of the country, that's when I think we really, you know, meshed and started bolting forward.
Yeah. One thing that I've always marveled at is Paul had this weird finger on the pulse of pop culture and music. It was so unique to me how he knew what music to use. It's almost like he was one step ahead of what was hot.
Right.
And obviously he knew how to tap into something when it became hot, but was that uniquely Paul, or was there other guys giving influence the same thing? How do you have any insight on it? Man, how did he know?
Yeah, I don't know how he knew. I always compared ECW to the band Nirvana. So, you know, we shot up real fast and, you know, boom, we were done.
Yeah.
Once the money ran out and everything, you know, it was done. The same with Nirvana, all the way to the top, boom, the bottom falls out. But yeah, I don't know where he got that influence or whether he had someone on the inside of the music world's going, hey, here's the next big thing coming out from, you know, this band or that band. I think it'll, you know, and if they were a fan, they'd go, oh, it could fit with this. Or I see what you're doing on TV here. Try this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Paul had a background in clubs and stuff. So I don't know if it's just that same sensibility and that, you know, carried over. It was always unique to me.
Yeah.
And like you said, I mean, to me, ECW is just synonymous with the 90s. Right. It is so, because it came up in the early 90s, and by, you know, whatever, by 2001, it was gone.
Right.
And it ran the course of the 90s. And when you look at it in the music and the style and that, you know, the extreme and everything, it fit so perfect in that decade. I don't think it could ever happen in another time period, obviously.
No.
It just,
and I don't think something like that will happen again. It just, you know, it was lightning in a bottle. And I don't think that there's going to be any kind of new wave of wrestling that would, you know, draw the attraction of, you know, that many people.
And I mean, it was so trendsetting because I mean, you know, WWE, WCW, they followed suit, right? What ECW was doing. I mean, ECW spawned the Attitude Era, and it was so trendsetting, and it totally changed the course of the business, When obviously, you know, Paul's in booking, but there came that point where then the ownership changed from Todd to Paul. Did the locker room have any sense of that? Did any feel of that? I know Todd was still around,
right?
A little after that, and into that, you know, the commissioner role still. So I know that there was maybe a different name on the checks, right? The whatever it was, HHG or whatever it was, Paul's group. And so, I mean, was that all there was, or did it, for a while at least, did it just kind of feel like the same business as usual?
No, I felt a step back a little bit. You know, I know, you know, the leadership was still Paul, and it was his idea we were following the whole time. But before that, I felt, you know, Todd was able to, you know, get a couple things in. Say, hey, why don't you try, you know, maybe we could do this with, you know, always pushing his guy. So like Sandman, let's do this with Sandman. But yeah, you know, I kind of felt that there was a little bit of the air let out of the bag with that, because he did start it. And, you know, if it wasn't for Todd, we wouldn't be talking right now.
Yeah. And I talked to Todd, and he, like I've said, he had the business background, right? He knew how he ran a business, right? His family had ran a business for a long time. And I feel like one of the first nails in the coffin was when that change happened, and you lost Todd Gordon trying to be able to keep it pulled back and grounded a little bit and try to say, oh, we can't do that. That's too much of a step. Yeah. Business-wise, we got to be smart, because then once it was all on Paul, suddenly Paul's just, let's go, and we'll deal with the fallout after. And I feel like that's where, again, Paul's a creative genius, but business-wise, not so much.
Right.
And when that's what worked with him and Todd to me. There was the balance, the creative, the business. When you lost that, Todd's influence, I believe that's kind of where things started to maybe unravel a little.
Yeah, I think so. I think that if we had not stayed Eastern, but gone extreme and stayed a little more regional than we did, travel-wise, I think we probably could have supported ourselves a little bit better as a company. You know, we're not flying everybody in to, you know, wherever, you know, and maybe if we did fly people into Chicago and Detroit or whatever, Maybe use a little more of the local talent to support the lower end of the show. Mm-hmm. And that would, you know, save a little money here and there. But, you know, Paul, give it to him, Paul and Tommy. I think Tommy spoke up probably about this to Paul more than anything, to be loyal to the guys who've been there.
Yeah, sure. And, well, and there was that unique situation of, right, Paul couldn't give everybody a contract and keep things in. So he had to give them dates, right? He had to keep them working, to keep them in the company. You know, he had to give these guys dates to try to keep them there.
I never had a contract. I was handshake from day one.
Right. And yeah, and some of these guys, though, like you said, if they were using local talent, they're only getting 1-2 dates a week as opposed to 3 or 4. Obviously, they're going to have to supplement. And who knows what will happen there? It's kind of that weird scenario of where they fell in the time period, right? They're coming out of the territories, coming into, you know, ECW kind of overlapped and had to deal with some of the pluses and minuses of two mindsets.
Yeah.
And then obviously there's Barely Illegal, right? The first ECW pay-per-view, and this has been talked about and dissected just over and over and over. And romanticized even, right? And I'm not saying some of it's not justified, but from your standpoint on that day, what was it like?
It was crazy for me. It was almost like, you know, an actor getting ready for their first Broadway debut or something like that. And I just, you know, we had to check in at 12:30 just to make sure everybody was in town, that everybody met. Okay, go have dinner, go get some sleep, whatever you want to do. I live 15 minutes away. I didn't feel like going home. I wanted to sit and take it all in because maybe I'll never do it again.
Sure.
So I just sat around and watched them finish setting up the lights and painting this and, you know, testing the sound and taking it all in. And I think that kind of helped me for down the line behind the scenes with wrestling. But yeah, I just wanted to take it all in. I just so energy charged. I was like, all right, let's go. You know, first match. Where's my first match? And like, I wasn't the first match out the door. And I was like, oh man, all right, come on. I got to get out. You know, I got to get out there and just, and then feeling off the energy of the crowd. Cause the ECW fans are so loyal to us. And, you know, they were there for us as much as we were for them. But you can just feel that energy between the two.
Right. And the fans played such an integral part in helping get it, you know, going. I mean, the backing and the support and the petitions and everything else to get it there. And then there's obviously, you know, there's obviously that, you know, all the stories of, oh, the generator going out just immediately when it's off air and this, that. But when it was done, when it was all said and done, bam, they're off the pay-per-view. They say the generators go out, right? And everything. Was the locker room just like, take a breath? I'm like, holy shit, we just did it. We did it. Yeah. We pulled it off. And what was that feeling like after? I mean, that had to be euphoric almost.
Oh yeah. It was celebrating winning the Stanley Cup or, you know, the major, you know, winning the World Series or something like that. We achieved our goal. I don't know if guys had thought of goals beyond that, but as a company, we were like, this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to get on pay-per-view and show them we can do it too. And we got on and we showed them we did it. And you know, we're something else to reckon with. not a huge enemy, but we're here and we're not going anywhere.
Yeah. And there were more pay-per-views, right? There was the weekly TV kept on. And eventually then, right, there started to be struggles, but then ECW landed on TNN with a second show. There's mixed feelings right here. Some people say by that time, it's too little too late. We already knew things were starting to roll downhill. Then there were some people who thought this could be our savior, right? TNN could be our savior. What was your perception like at that time when the TNN deal came? Where did you fall?
I didn't know if they would be our savior, but I thought it was our next step. I thought it was we had to level up to a larger span, a larger audience.
Yeah.
We weren't getting syndicated everywhere. It also upgraded our look. If we were in an arena setting as opposed to a, you know, rec center or things like that. And trust me, we made some of those places look great compared to what they really were.
Yeah.
But I thought it was the next step up in the progression of the company. I knew that some things had to be pulled back, but I still felt that we could get away with our theory of extreme wrestling.
Sure. Well, and how quickly, though, did you see, because obviously TNN wound up not being very supportive, right? There wasn't a lot of promotion. Right. They weren't really pushed back. So how quickly did you and the guys start noticing that, okay, what's going on here? We're on this channel, but they don't seem to be kind of backing us very well.
Yeah, we'd done a TV taping, and they didn't like it for some reason. I don't know why. And it was not in a small place. It was in a convention center, so it was a decent building. And I thought the matches were fine. I don't know what they didn't like about the camera angles or the editing or the sound or the lights or whatever. So the first couple of weeks we showed old stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, I hope that's not a mistake. And that's when the fight began. We did a TV taping down in Nashville that I thought had a great look. Big building, intense matches. I felt like we were the locker room stepped up a level with how we were treated, and I think, you know, those two things needed to come together. That we needed to step up both at the same time, and I just thought, okay, this is cool. Now, you know, we'll be here. We can do it like this. Then we were back to. We'll just use the arena tapes. Nothing wrong with the arena tapes, but it became, we'll just use the regular TV. And from then I got the sense that since there was no one from TNN coming around to watch us to see what we're doing, I was like, this isn't going to last too long. And then we got WWE's negotiating to come in. I'm like, oh, we're just crash test dummies.
Sure. Right. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of, it's a little shame, right? Because ECW, there was a lot clicking at this time, right? There was a magazine, there were figures, there was a video game.
Yeah.
And if they could have, got on the right channel, that would have been supportive of, okay, this is a new product. Let's run with it. Who knows, but by this time, ECW was, it's like they were running just to pay for the next step, right? The pay-per-views were running. So it's almost they needed something and they didn't get it. When things were struggling there, did you encounter any of those pay issues that guys talk about so much?
Oh, absolutely. We would get a paycheck on Saturday, fly home Sunday, and at the bank, the closest bank of New York you could find, because that's what the checks were written on, and get there before someone else does.
Yep.
And cash your check. We'd get sign guy and I lived close to each other that then we'd hop in the car and take off. And they'd say, well, there's not enough money in the bank. Or, Jack Victor was here before us.
Yeah, that's what I talked to Bill Wiles. That's what he was saying, right? As soon as they got that check, it's like, bam, let's get to the bank. Try to be the first guys there.
There was one night we were in Wichita, Kansas. And they kept saying, checks are coming in, we're flying the checks in, they're coming to you. And Paulie wasn't there. Tommy was running the show. It was when Paulie was, negotiating with with Fox.
Yeah.
And so his assistant, I drove her that day. And that night we sat at the Wichita airport till 1 o'clock in the morning when the last FedEx plane came in and there was no package for us. And people think that poor Debbie Beaumont, she's passed away since, but people think that she knew everything that was going on. Well, if she knew what was going on, we weren't going to be sitting at the airport until 1 o'clock in the morning and drive to Kansas to catch a 7:30 flight that morning.
Yeah.
It's a lot to that and coming home and saying, well, all I have are my draws. Here's a check. I don't know if it's any good. That didn't help any either.
Yeah, man. And so how smooth was Paul to BS and the guys, right? Because I've seen video even after ECW had folded that of guys like Balls Mahoney doing these shows saying, oh, I still think it's going to come back. I still think something's going to happen. Some of these guys, and I love, no offense to Balls and, rest in peace and everything else. But some of these guys were really, truly believed.
Yeah.
This thing. So how good was Paul at selling this stuff?
These guys in circles. You know, the last time that we had seen him, I guess, was the Massacre on 34th Street pay-per-view. And guys, I'm working as hard as I can. I'm out there. I'm talking to this network and that network, and we're really close to getting something done. Just please hang in there. And he was great at it. And I think most of the guys were hanging in there because a lot of them probably didn't think that, you know, WWE or WCW or, you know, TNA or whoever was, you know, coming along at the time, yeah, next to WWE weren't going to take them. I didn't think somebody was going to take me. And I had gone back to working a regular job during the week. I had been working in promotions for the company. And I was like, well, they're not sending me anywhere. I better go find something else to do.
Yeah.
And was, do this on the weekends.
Was Tommy Dreamer, was he in an awkward position with this?
Oh yeah.
I mean, was he trying to spread the BS? Was he, what was he doing? I mean, how in touch was he with what was happening?
I think he knew more than letting us know. And I think he was trying to be a buffer between anybody killing Paul. Mm-hmm. and I think he wanted to keep it going too. I think he was willing to, that if he had found a way to save the company, he would have taken it over.
Right.
He was, you know, he drank the Kool-Aid just as much as anybody else did, but I think he, you know, he probably knew a little bit more and probably didn't drink as much Kool-Aid as some of us.
Yeah. Were you at the last ECW show in Pine Bluff, Arkansas?
I was.
What was it like? I mean, because, you know, there was the send off kind of at the end and everybody kind of knew. What was the morale in the locker room there?
I think that it was half and half. I think half the guys were saying, well, it was good while it lasted. And I think half of them were like, well, you know, we'll see what happens. We still have, there were a couple of shows scheduled. I think there was a pay-per-view scheduled, and maybe we'll, you know, we'll all meet at the pay-per-view. And then that got killed. I think it was kind of half and half, you know, guys holding on. It was their dream too, as much as it was Paul's.
Yeah. Did you ever get any official word? Did anybody ever call you and say, hey, Jim, yeah, we're done. That's it. There's not going to be any more. Or did you just, because you never got another call, you just knew?
And just not until, you know, I kept hearing, hold on. We'll get something done. And the pay-per-view was canceled. And that's when I thought, man, we're done. You know, was Paul going to work as an announcer for WWE and be able to fund ECW and let him, you know, let us do our thing on the weekends? You know, maybe that could have happened. I don't know. That was a hope. Yeah. But that around that was when I was like, we got to go back into the real world.
Yeah. Do you think there was anything? There's obviously a lot of factors involved, but do you think there was, what was something that maybe could have been tweaked or changed that maybe could have prevented the downfall? Do you, I mean, I've heard people talk that, hey, it was too big, too quick. And then there's some people just say, hey, it's just a victim of circumstance, right? It was too big to be small and not big enough to be big. And it's just, it is what it is. And it just happened. There's not
much. I think it's really a combination of the two. I think we wanted to grow, but we couldn't. And we were just, you know, and the situations were changing. I always say that if it wasn't for the Clinton administration, ECW wouldn't have been around. If it had been a more tight-knit, hardcore, you know, right-wing Republican Party, I don't think we would have been on TV.
Maybe not. They would have shut that down.
And with, you know, with someone coming in after Clinton, I was like, we're not going to be able to do that anymore.
Yeah. Congressional hearings on ECW and stuff. So, like I said, you were there through the whole thing, right? The whole run of the original ECW. Let's just talk about, focus on that. What are there any matches that really jump out at you and stand out as your favorites? Give us an example of something.
I don't look them in. There are some that are my favorite. My favorites are working with Eddie Guerrero and Dean Malenko and Jerry Lynn and Lance Storm. Same type of match. Great guys to work with. Had fun with them. But I look at some of the matches that I did that I felt were important to the company. I did the three-way match, the triple threat match, or whatever you call them nowadays, between Shane Douglas, Sabu, and Terry Funk. The night the line was crossed. 60-minute Broadway.
Yeah,
I think that got us on the worldwide tape trader market. That's what really put us on the target of wrestling fans. Wow, I heard they had this great match in Philadelphia that went 60 minutes and nobody won. But I got to see it. And then after that, I think the next step up was Barely Legal. Mm-hmm. And I got to do the Sabu Taz match, where the buildup, if you go back and watch the buildup, they didn't touch each other for 2 years.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. And I thought that was something that was, you know, that just that whole night was important to the company. But that was supposed, wasn't the main event, but it was the main attraction of the evening.
Sure. And you hear lots of wild stories about ECW, right? And I know maybe your approach was a little different, right? Because you weren't a single guy, maybe having as much fun as some of these other guys. But do you have, and I'm not saying, I'm not saying it has to be in that vein, but do you have an ECW story that maybe you haven't talked about or say, and again, I'm not trying to break up anybody's marriages out there or anything else, but is there something maybe a little more non-wrestling related, something fun, maybe a story that you have to share?
It's not one that I haven't told, but I've told this before.
Okay.
I drove a lot of the people, a lot of the guys. Just because Paul trusted me, because I wasn't drinking. I didn't drink. So obviously I didn't hang out with a lot of that stuff going on.
Sure.
We had turned down, Paul turned down China to come into ECW. Didn't think it was a fit. Uh-huh. And then China became a hit at WWE. So he was like, what do I do? So he brings in the world's largest female bodybuilder from the Howard Stern show.
Nicole Bass.
So we were doing a run in Louisiana, and Paul said, can you drive Nicole Bass around with you that weekend?
Oh.
Okay. And she, very nice person, very sweet lady, had no problems with her. So it was myself. And I said I used to drive Debbie Beaumont, who was Paul's assistant. People would know her as the nasty ticket lady at the box office. So we're driving, and I pull into the McDonald's, and there's another story tied into the McDonald's. And we're driving along, and I like classic rock. And so Born to Be Wild's playing. So pull into McDonald's, get out. And turn the key off, and Debbie and I get out, and in the car we can still hear the worst rendition of Born to Be Wild you've ever heard.
Oh man.
but the time, the McDonald's thing at the time, Beanie Babies were the hot thing. And McDonald's had Beanie Babies in their kid meals.
Yeah.
Al Snow and I were getting Beanie Babies for our kids. So we were eating kids' meals. And when we meet up at the show, we're exchanging Beanie Babies. Wouldn't expect that at an ECW show.
A Beanie, well, again, that's so 90s. A Beanie
that's
Baby.
That's so non-ECW, too.
Absolutely. How many kids' meals did Al Snow eat just to fill him up?
Right.
Oh. Beanie Baby exchanges in an ECW show with you and Al Snow. That's
great.
Oh man. Wow. So you've also worked some of the reunion show since, right? You did appear in the WWE ECW, correct?
Yes. They're the only ones I've done.
Oh, just the WWE ECW.
Yep.
You didn't do any of the Hardcore Homecomings or any of those, right?
No, nope. I did not.
Nope. Okay. So There was obviously a lot of misses about the WWE ECW, but lots of people talk about the first one night stand as really probably being the closest post ECW thing to capturing the feel and the spirit. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think that was our ability, and I think we pulled it off to say thank you to the fans and say goodbye. I think if it had ended there with no WWE ECW, it would have been great. I just there was a meeting beforehand, and Vince McMahon came in and said, guys, go out there and give them the show that they're expecting. And we did.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not a fan of the sci-fi run, the WWE ECW. I feel, I don't know. There's a mixed opinion. I feel like Vince was trying to undercut the brand of ECW a little bit with it. Obviously, you know, it's conjectured. I mean, no one's going to know unless he ever came out and said, but I feel like he's got his hands full with other things right now that I don't believe that's a priority for him at the moment. But yeah, obviously
I think he would have done the same thing if they had done a WCW show.
Sure. Absolutely. Have
undermined the name.
Yeah. Which is wild to me because there's no more, it's not a competition anymore, right? You own it. Why not?
You won.
Why not try to use the value it has instead of just, I mean, you've already proven that you're the product.
Right.
And you now, but whatever. That's a whole different story. but what are you talk to, you're still out there working, right? You still do some shows, lots of appearances, different things. Who are some of the guys from ECW that you're still close with? I think you and John Finnegan still, you know, you're still pretty close, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. We've always lived no less than 5 miles away from each other since we've known each other.
Yeah. And obviously John was there for the entire ECW run as well. I mean,
right.
I think there's no other talent.
Right. That was it. We're the only two that made it from without leaving and coming back. A lot of guys left and came back. Sure, we're the only ones who are there from day one to the end of it. Yeah. But yeah, I see him every once in a while. He only referees for a company called ECWA.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. And they run about five, six shows a year. I work for them occasionally when they need me. I'm there. Yeah. The guy bought my wrestling ring from me, so I'm there. I'm happy to work for him. But yeah, him, Mike Keener, the other referee that we had at the end of the run of the original ECW, we're close. Yeah, since I've gotten back in the ring, because I took a long time where I didn't do anything in front of the ring, in front of the people. I've hooked up with a lot of the guys, AC Loke. I've always been good friends with Paul Richard, if you remember him as a referee with ECW.
Mm-hmm.
Paul and I are very good friends. But yeah, Loke, it's more of the local guys, you know, that you see at the fan fest. Francine, I'm very good friends with. Talk to her a lot.
Yeah.
She only lives like a half hour away from me. So we're pretty friendly.
Yeah, it's always, I mean, that's not even non-ECW. It's always been a trademark of pro wrestling, right? A guy you worked with in a territory or an area for years, and then you don't see each other for 20 or 30 years or whatever, and you show up at a convention, and it's just like you never missed a step, right? You're just good, you know, and everything else. So, you've done a lot of other things, right? You've promoted shows, you've ran dabbled in lots of different things. Is refereeing still a passion for you though? I mean, is that where you still get a lot of enjoyment from getting out there and doing it?
Yeah, it has. I took a long time off from being in the ring. I helped run the Monster Factory for a while. And then just so the story doesn't go on, just kind of split off in different directions. And the promotion that we had with the Monster Factory, the matches themselves, we called OTW, Old Time Wrestling.
Right.
So we kind of split. We went and had our own school and promotion and did that for a while. I had a business partner with me who moved back to Canada. And so for like a 15-year run, I did Monster Factory and OTW and promoted. Helped train, ran the place. And it just got to be too much because I was doing too much on my own. The days of a show, I get up at 7 o'clock in the morning, go get the rental truck at 9 o'clock, get a crew to load it up, go do the show, you know, and then I'm not home again until 2 o'clock in the morning. Too long for a guy my age. and there were other factors, some health factors. I had had a heart attack, and I was just, you know, let's slow it down. So I mentioned ECWA. The guys bought my ring, and they were like, hey, do you want a ref? First time you and John had worked together since the second one-night stand. I'm like, yeah, that's cool. I'll do that. So it was a Super 8. They run a Super 8 every year.
Sure. Yeah.
That they're known for. Yeah. So I did that and worked for them a little bit. And that was when the passion came back. And what I like about it is that I can be in the ring and feel that emotion again with, wow, we got the crowd with, you know, you guys have the crowd with you. Let's really bring them in. Yeah. And I'm able to give feedback afterward, you know, where I think I was giving feedback and I don't think it was, guys were that set on what I had to say. But now that I'm in the ring and right there with them and can feel it, I think they take it a little more than I did just, you know, the old guy standing over there in the corner watching matches.
Yeah. When I talked to John, I don't want to say give him a hard time, but you guys a couple of different times have tried podcasting and I always enjoyed it. I mean, you and John did one and then you did one with Joel Goodhart there for a while. Mm-hmm. And there was someone else who was the third. I can't remember who the third was in that.
Well, I'm doing one now with Mike Freeland, and and he has Front Row Material, and part of the show is called Front Row Referee.
Okay,
so it's myself and Nick Papagiulio, who does local stuff here in the Jersey, the Philadelphia area, and we'll switch guys in and out. But that's what I've been doing lately. That's once a week.
Yeah.
We've been a little slow lately because of, you know, different thing, you know, personal life stuff. So we slowed it down a little bit, but yeah, it's fun to do. I like doing it. I think referees have a voice that needs to be heard out there, whether it's myself or Kyoto or whoever is doing a podcast.
There's several out there doing them now.
It's a different set of eyes on pieces of history.
Yeah. Cause referees are often underappreciated, right? Because, you know, so many people, they don't notice the referee or whatever else and don't realize, hey, that's the key, right?
Sure.
That's right.
I like about that direction is that if someone doesn't know I did a match, it could be the biggest match in the history of professional wrestling. If they don't know I did that match, I did my job.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. It's such an underappreciated position and in its importance. People often forget there's a third man in that ring.
Right.
And it's important. Like we said, though, you do lots of appearances, lots of convention stuff. Anything planned? Because obviously WrestleMania weekend's in Philly this year.
Right.
Do you have anything on your slate yet for WrestleMania weekend?
I had one thing set up, and it actually just got canceled. So I'm actually talking to the WrestleCon folks about doing something. They've got some things planned that they haven't announced yet. So I'm talking to them about doing some of that stuff. A company called SPO Wrestling, Superpowers of Wrestling, which is run by Johnny Cashmere from the Backstreet Boys. They run Sunday afternoons. It's every 6 weeks or so. And I've been working with them. So they're actually running that Sunday of WrestleMania. And they do afternoon shows. So if you're in the South Jersey area, it's probably about a half hour away from where WrestleMania will be at 2:30. Look it up, SPO Wrestling. But that's the only thing in stone so far. But like I said, I got some things brewing and, you know, there's still plenty of time to announce them.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be obviously a fun weekend. Lots of speculation, right? With it being in Philly, there's no Hall of Fame announcement. So what's going to go on? Lots of talk. I know Sandman supposedly assigned a Legends deal. Was that going to, you know, is that going to be something Hall of Fame related involved? You know, none of that's come out yet, but it's obviously a lot of excitement for ECW fans with WrestleMania weekend being in Philly and what's going to happen. Lots of shows obviously paying tribute to ECW on that weekend, some of the indie shows. So it's a good time for ECW fans on that weekend. So if people want to keep up with you and like you said, you're doing a lot, you do lots of appearances, conventions, you're still out there referee.
Doing seminars too.
Doing seminars. You got the podcast. You're an indie
company looking for referee seminars.
You got lots of shirts. I mean, you got shirts available. You got all kinds of stuff going on out there. What is the best way for someone that wants to follow you to see what Jim's got going on and to keep track of all this? What's the best way for them to follow you?
The easiest way is on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it. Sure, and it's easy enough. It's at Jim Molineaux, and it's J-I-M M-O-L-I-N-E-A-U-X, all lowercase. You can catch me on there. If you want to contact me, it has my email there. Okay. I'm on Facebook, pretty much the same way, Jim Molineaux. And that's really it. I have Instagram, but I only have it because I have to do things. I do things like this on Instagram sometimes.
Yeah.
I don't post anything. So if you want to follow me, have a go at it, but I really don't do anything on there.
Yeah. So everybody go follow Jim on X on Twitter, X, whatever it's called now. I still Twitter to me.
Yeah.
Because obviously, you know, anything you've got, I'm sure you'll post there or share the shows, you know, that's being posted. So you can keep track of what you're doing there. Like I said, he's got some shirts. Go out there and, you know, buy some shirts. If you got a company out there, would like to bring in Jim to do a seminar, contact him. He said the email is in your bio on X to reach out for booking inquiries. But Jim, thank you for your time. Like I said, this is kind of an overview. But man, there's so much for you to talk about. Cause like I said, you and John, the only guys there from beginning to end. So I feel like at some point we need to do another one and dive in a little more detail to some more specific events and matches and things like that, and less of an overview. So I think we got to have you back on the show again in the future and really
dive in. That's fine with me. It was a great talk.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you for your time, Jim. Like I said, down the road, I'll be back in touch. We'll do a follow-up, dig a little deeper. So,
all right, great.
Support This Is Extreme and buy the This Is Extreme shirt. Show the world that you are part of the revolution and that you support our podcast and the history of ECW. Go to tinyurl.com/ECW pod shirt and buy yours today.
All right, and we are back on This Is Extreme. I am Dave Dynasty. Thank you to Jim Molineaux for joining me for that wonderful, wonderful interview. And hey, guys, if you'd like to hear some more of me, if you just can't get enough old Dave Dynasty in your life, make sure you check out my other podcast. I have the Wrestling Nostalgia Podcast, where I talk about other wrestling history that's not ECW. There's a lot of I hone in quite a bit on the Midwest, the WWA, Dick the Bruiser stuff, because that is kind of my key prime interest in wrestling. But I talk about a lot of stuff, but it's a lot of wrestling history. And as the title states, Wrestling Nostalgia. If you're into horror movies, check out my horror movie podcast, Listen to Their Screams. We review horror movies on there. We play games. We talk about horror news and birthday and movie anniversaries, all kinds of fun stuff. So check that out. It's called Listen to Their Screams. Make sure you subscribe to those. And whatever podcast platform you like, make sure you're subscribing to this podcast there as well. And if the option is there, please give us a rating and review, as that helps us in those algorithms. It helps us come up when people are listening to other shows. We appreciate all your support. We appreciate all your sharing, your responses, your likes on social media, listening to the podcast and everything else. It is truly, truly meaningful to us. And it's what helps the show grow, helps the show network and you know, expand our base. So thank you for doing that. And until next time, wherever you go, whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep it extreme.